You know, sometimes on a really bad market day, I'll say, all right, everybody, take a deep breath. Same applies on a big up day, too. Nothing is all bad or all good. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Washington, D.C., once again, today I'm Kai Ryssdal. It is Wednesday, the 5th of February. Good as always to have you along, everybody. We begin today with an oldie but a goodie. The stock market, it is sometimes said, is not the economy, and the economy is not the stock market. That is true, but it's also true that those two things are related. Distant cousins, maybe a time or two removed. So what I'm about to say should be taken with that in mind. There was a general sigh of relief to be heard today in stocks pretty much worldwide, Asia to Europe to Wall Street, based, by and large, on a couple of things. Relief that the coronavirus might, and I'm stressing might here, not be as bad as had been predicted. Oil was up as well. That's a good sign for the global economy, if not necessarily for drivers. There was a bounce in American manufacturing last month. I think we told you about that yesterday. Also a good sign. So insert once again the caveat here, a sigh of relief might be warranted. But that said, much as when you get sick with a regular bug, the drag from coronavirus, assuming it's not going to be as bad as we had feared, is still going to be with us for a while. Exhibit A, all those flights to and from China that have been canceled in some cases for months. Yes, that means people can't get there or out of there. Also, though, cargo. Because the bellies of those planes don't fly empty. Marketplace's Jack Stewart gets us going.
There aren't many people flying in and out of China right now. Dorna Rhodes at Embry-Riddle Aeronautical University says that means less capacity for crates and pallets too.
What most people probably don't think about it is a sizable portion of the air freight actually comes in the belly of an aircraft. So it's in that section that most passengers think is where all their luggage is.
Depending on the plane, a flight can carry the equivalent of two semi-trucks worth of cargo. According to figures from IATA, the International Air Transport Association, globally, cargo generates 9% of airline revenues, or more than twice that of first-class tickets. Jesse Cohen, an air cargo and freight transportation consultant, says for flights from China, that can sometimes be even higher.
A really good passenger flight, you might see 15 to 20% of the revenue on that flight being generated by cargo.
Some of that money comes from businesses that sell perishable goods like food and flowers, which need rapid shipping. But Cohen says high-value products like laptops and cell phones are also worth paying the extra to send by air, so they're not tied up at sea and can get to market quickly.
A lot of your electronics, higher-end electronics, is manufactured in China or assembled in China and shipped over via air cargo.
About one-third of air cargo is transported on passenger planes. The rest goes on freight-only flights, and they are still operating to China. Neither FedEx nor UPS wanted to do an interview, but both said they're following federal guidance and they're giving advice to crew on how to stay safe. There is one type of shipment that hasn't seen a downturn, says Eric Kulish, the air cargo editor at FreightWaves.
You're seeing medical supplies going in, whether it's masks or gowns or other relief supplies.
He says the economic effects of flight suspensions are not as bad as they might have been. It is after the busy holiday shopping season in the US, and the Chinese New Year holiday means factory output would have been lower right now anyway, reducing demand for shipping of all types. I'm Jack Stewart for Marketplace.
Wall Street on this Wednesday, as I said, the relief rally continues. We will have the details when we do the numbers. Today in mattress news, a phrase I am reasonably sure has never before been heard on this program, Casper, the direct-to-consumer mattress-in-a-box company, lowered its IPO price today, now $12 to $13 a share when it starts trading tomorrow. That's down from $17 to $19 a piece a couple of days ago, and it values the company at about $500 million, half of what it was at its high. Marketplace's Mario Segarra reports now on what went not entirely right.
In 2015, Wes Muntz went mattress shopping, and the salesman was pushing a $3,000 mattress, saying stuff like,
"You have to get it, and this is the best deal I'm going to ever give you, and here, sign this, and, you know, just put $100 down."
He caved, gave him $100.
It just felt, felt really terrible.
Muntz was exactly the kind of customer Casper was going after when it launched in 2014. Michael Magnuson is with the mattress comparison website goodbed.com.
Casper's story when they came to market was essentially, you're being lied to and you're being cheated, and we are here to save you.
Casper sold a vacuum-sealed mattress in a box directly to consumers. You got 100 days to try it, and someone would come take it back if you changed your mind. Rita McGrath at Columbia Business School says this direct-to-consumer model was much harder before the internet.
Consumers needed to go to a physical place to discover your product, right? Today, that's not necessary.
The mattress-in-a-box model sounded great to Wes Muntz, especially after his in-store experience. So he and his wife Whitney tried it. They bought a queen online. But it wasn't a Casper mattress. It came from a different bed-in-a-box company called Lisa.
It was $50 or $100 cheaper than the Casper.
And now you understand one of Casper's big problems. It wasn't the first company to sell a mattress in a box, but it was among the first and arguably the most prominent. Michael Magnuson says the market quickly got crowded.
Since Casper, there's probably about 150 that have popped up. For the most part, they were following a roadmap that Casper had very successfully laid out.
That's the thing about the direct-to-consumer model. It's really easy to get into, but hard to keep competitors out. I'm Marielle Segarra for Marketplace.
I went out for a cup of coffee with a colleague here at Marketplace DC today. Took kind of a roundabout route because she said she wanted to see if the new Sephora store down the block had opened up yet. And sure enough, it has. Business model transformation brought to life, because the beauty retailer that brought makeup out from behind the department store counter and into the mall is looking for growth outside those malls in standalone stores and shopping centers. Marketplace's Kristen Schwab has more on that new strategy.
I don't know if you've heard, but malls are dying because they can be a hassle. Online shopping has made us dread traffic and parking and figuring out where the Sephora inside the mall even is. Alexis DeSalva is with Mintel.
There's a move away from malls, but that doesn't mean that the in-store experience is deteriorating. I think it's just evolving.
The new Sephoras will focus on products people need regularly, like hair and skincare. DeSalva says the standalone stores will be easier to pop into and easier to navigate. They'll be 1,500 square feet smaller than the mall versions.
We are seeing that in general in retail overall, like a tighter assortment that's geared towards the essentials.
This model has worked before. Beauty chain Ulta has lots of stores in strip malls, but the strip mall shopper is different. Sephora will need a new strategy to get them in the door, says Jenny Vrylu, who worked for Clinique and co-directs the Yale Center for Customer Insights.
You know, if I was just in the store a month ago, I don't want it to look exactly the same. I want to come in and be delighted with the latest.
And if the casual shopper doesn't make it to the store, there's still Sephora's online business.
Having the option to allow for delivery from a local store could be, you know, a direction that they could take it.
Lou says more brands are using regional stores to compete with same-day shipping. Because these days, Sephora isn't just worried about Ulta, but about Amazon, too. I'm Kristen Schwab for Marketplace.
We spent a chunk of the program yesterday on a conversation I had with former Fed Chair Janet Yellen and David Malpass. He's the president of the World Bank. We spent a lot of time on global growth, the ramifications of interest rates being as low as they are for as long as they have been there, and the big and growing pile of global debt. And then we started taking questions from the audience. Here you go.
David, next question to you and about the global economy. Does growth in income inequality in advanced economies pose a risk to the global economy? Income inequality, say, here.
Well, the U.S. is showing pretty good data on inequality. The Gini coefficient is going the right way on that, and the median income has been going up. So then if you refine that and say...
Inequality in this economy is still a huge problem, right?
Yeah. So if you say, why do we have so many super rich, and is that a negative? I guess I'll defend that little part of the question and say they are pretty good about reinvesting in their own businesses and creating businesses that have been helpful to the whole world. But I want to buy into the whole thrust of the question that median income outside the U.S. simply hasn't been growing, and that's a major problem. And that means we need small businesses, we need skills, we need women in the workforces, we need health and education that allow people to earn income. They have to get started.
So let me just add to that. So first, let me say that I completely agree with David. He's emphasized the benefits across the board, but especially to low-income people, of a very strong labor market fostering increased labor force participation in the United States. But since 1979, the median male worker in the United States has seen no gain in real wages. And I don't think we're on a path to improvement where if we just keep the economy where it is, operating with a tight labor market, this problem is going to disappear. It's very serious. And to my mind, it's driving a lot of the populism we see in the United States. And it's fueling discontent with trade, protectionism. And given that the growth of trade that we've seen over the last 50 years and development of global supply chains has been one of the most important factors boosting growth all around the world, this is a trend in developed countries that is not going to be good globally for reducing poverty.
Janet, you mentioned economic inequality driving some of the political things that have been happening here and elsewhere. Here's the flip side of that question. Does polarization of our politics have economic consequences, do you think?
Well, it's certainly making it hard to enact policy changes. You know, David's been mentioning, I agree with him, you need structural policies to address slow growth. We're not working to find common ground to put in place policies that, you know, for inequality, some combination of training, education, and improving the safety net for people who are working in an economy where jobs with the traditional supports are disappearing. You know, we need to be addressing all of those things, and I think the polarization is making it harder to find good solutions.
Janet Yellen there, also David Malpass, the president of the World Bank. She, of course, used to run the Federal Reserve. Lots more from that conversation. Their thoughts on small businesses, for instance, and how important they are in the global economy. You can get that on our Corner Office podcast. Coming up,
a squeaky clean, sanitized view of the world.
That is not the way the internet works. But first, let's do the numbers. Dow Industrial's up 483 today, 1.6%, closed at 29,290. I personally had my money on the really happy music. I don't know. NASDAQ up 40 points, 0.4%, finished at 95.08. The S&P 500 up 37, 1.1%, 33.34. There, drug maker Merck beat analysts' fourth quarter expectations, but investors weren't quite ready to swallow its plan to spin off a women's health division and some other operations. Thus, Merck down 2.8% today. Eli Lilly posted strong profits last month, up 2.7% today. News in the auto sector, General Motors posted better than anticipated results for the fourth quarter, even with that strike. GM zoomed up 1.9%. Ford, though, down 9.4% today. Bonds fell. Yield on the 10-year Treasury note rose to 1.64%. You're listening to Marketplace.
Looking for the highest interest rate on your cash? At Public.com, you can earn 5.1% APY with a high-yield cash account. And while we can't say it's officially the highest interest rate out there, we can say this. It's a higher rate than Robinhood, a higher rate than SoFi, a higher rate than Marcus, a higher rate than Wealthfront, frankly, a higher rate than Capital One, a higher rate than Ally, a higher rate than Barclays, a way higher rate than Bank of America and Chase, a higher rate than Citi, Wells Fargo, Discover, and it's a higher rate than American Express, too. So if you want to start earning 5.1% APY on your cash, check out public.com. We can't say it's the highest interest rate, but it's pretty darn up there. This is paid for by Public Investing, 5.1% APY as of March 26, 2024, and is subject to change. A high-yield cash account is a secondary brokerage account with Public Investing, member FINRA/SIPC. Funds from this account are automatically deposited into partner banks where they earn a variable interest and are eligible for FDIC insurance. Neither Public Investing nor any of its affiliates is a bank. U.S. only. Learn more at public.com/disclosure/high-yield-account.
This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdal. Mortgage applications jumped last week to their highest level in almost 7 years. Why, you ask? Well, here's one reason. Coronavirus. The logic goes like this. Demand for U.S. Treasury bonds goes up in uncertain times, and that, because of the way bonds work, pushes down the yields on those bonds, that is, the interest rates that they pay. And so, mortgage rates, which are tied to the 10-year Treasury, fall as well. 3.71% for a 30-year fixed-rate mortgage, says the Mortgage Bankers Association. However, most of the demand for mortgages has been from homeowners refinancing existing loans, not buying new places. And that, as Marketplace's Amy Scott reports, could spell some trouble.
Look back at the last three recessions, as Wharton finance professor Nikolai Rusanov has, and you'll notice a pattern of more people refinancing their mortgages to take cash out of their homes.
Cash out refinancing peaks about 12 to 24 months before the onset of a recession.
A cash out refi replaces an existing mortgage with a larger loan, and you pocket the difference. Rusanov says the job market typically slows down before a recession officially starts, so people may be tempted to tap into their growing equity if they're not getting raises or they lose their job. Others may be afraid.
Households are uncertain about what is going to happen with their income, what is going to happen with their jobs, and they realize that maybe while they have this home equity, it's better to convert it into something liquid.
Cash out refis have been growing over the last 5 years, says Andy Walden with data and analytics firm Black Knight.
In fact, in the third quarter of last year, we saw cash out withdrawals hit their highest volume since the Great Recession.
Still, we're a long way from those bad old days. Economist Len Kiefer with Freddie Mac says in 2006, homeowners extracted about $320 billion of equity through refinancing, compared to an estimated $80 billion last year. And most of them are using the money to shore up their finances or reinvest in their house.
40% of them were using them to pay off debts or other bills. And the next most common use, about 30%, was for repairs.
So not a lot of trips to Tahiti. They're also leaving plenty of equity in the home. So when the next downturn does eventually come, they should be in better shape to ride it out. I'm Amy Scott for Marketplace.
With all due respect to television and its whole peak content thing, there is an audio content story today that's of note. Spotify says it's going to buy the sports and entertainment podcast company The Ringer, founded and run by Bill Simmons, formerly of ESPN. No details yet, but this is just the latest in a string of aggressive and, one imagines, costly purchases that Spotify has been making. Marketplace's Andy Euler looks at the audio mergers and acquisition strategy.
On Spotify's earnings call this morning, CEO Daniel Ek had this to say on the acquisition, quote, "What we really did with The Ringer, I think, is we bought the next ESPN." Zach Mack, who used to produce podcasts for The Ringer and now works at Vox Media Podcast Network, thinks otherwise.
It seems so different because The Ringer just behaves so much differently than ESPN. I don't even think they would compare themselves to ESPN.
But he says in buying The Ringer, Spotify is definitely acquiring a popular podcast brand with a built-in audience.
They have just like a bunch of big shows that do really well for them.
Spotify's been on a spending spree over the past year. It's already shelled out $400 million for three podcast companies. Peter Kafka is senior correspondent at Recode. He says Spotify is looking to get a few things out of all this podcast spending.
They think they'll get new users if they have podcasts. They think they can get more advertising dollars by creating their own advertising and putting on podcasts. They think podcast users on Spotify are less likely to churn, that is, go use another service.
He says expanding further beyond music also gives Spotify the opportunity to avoid paying 60 to 70 cents on the dollar to record companies and licensing firms when users stream songs. Musicologist Asher Tobin-Chodos.
It's been hard to make money, real money, selling music since the end of the 20th century. And Spotify, for all of its technical ingenuity, hasn't changed that basic fact of the industry.
Terms weren't disclosed, but some sources estimate it's around $100 million. Spotify is a publicly traded company, so the exact numbers will come to light soon. I'm Andy Euler for Marketplace.
Reddit, which is by turns a social news aggregator, also a discussion platform, sometimes a rating site of sorts, it turns 15 this year, an eternity, we know, in the digital age. But just 5 years ago, Reddit was one of the worst corners of the internet, a place where you could find violent racism, child pornography, and almost everything in between. Now, while still not entirely safe for work, it's a lot less scary, and ad revenue has started growing again. Marketplace's Jasmine Garst reports on Reddit's recovery and whether its changes could be an answer for the rest of social media.
When Steve Huffman came back to be the CEO of Reddit, it wasn't exactly a triumphant return.
It was really, really tough. The thought process I had at the time was it would be a real shame if Reddit didn't live up to its potential or even worse, cease to exist.
Huffman co-founded the social media platform in 2005 with a utopian vision, total freedom of speech. The site is separated into communities like message boards, and there's a community for just about anything. Like there's one group with over 19 million members dedicated to epiphanies they had in the shower. Gems like, women's longer average lifespan is partially canceled out by longer wait times at public restrooms. Eminem would make a great auctioneer. Toxic communities also began flourishing, says Christine Ligorio-Chafkin, author of We Are the Nerds, about Reddit's history. She says parts of the site were
filled with hate, filled with bad behavior, filled with harassment, bullying, and a lot of behaviors that, when taken as one individual post, might not seem that bad. But once a community forms around it, clearly showed a picture of kind of depravity.
That very community structure actually made it easier for Reddit to shut down the most problematic content. It's less of a challenge to take down an entire group that self-identifies as racist than individual users on the loose, a problem sites like Twitter face.
It's our greatest strength. The communities that may end up getting banned or quarantined do us a favor and all stand in one place for us. That makes it really convenient.
Huffman banned some offensive communities and quarantined others. Only members could see them in search results. And advertisements were removed. Not that there were a lot.
Now, in 2015, we were not burdened with advertisers because nobody wanted to talk to us.
Jasmine Enberg is an analyst with eMarketer.
Those cleanup efforts have not only helped some brands feel more comfortable advertising on Reddit, but have also brought in some new users.
Reddit now has 430 million users, up 30% from last year. And if you use Reddit, you've noticed more of this.
Energizer Ultimate Lithium. It's the number one longest-lasting battery.
Even though ad revenue is growing, it was still only about $119 million last year, according to eMarketer. Twitter made $700 million on ads just in the last quarter. Still, Huffman is optimistic.
I think we've paid down a lot of that debt. It was one pitch at a time, one advertiser at a time. And as we've grown, it's become easier and easier.
But there have been a lot of questions about why some communities don't just get shut down. Like the group called Watch People Die. That's exactly what it sounds like. It was quarantined, but Reddit didn't remove it until the group put up video footage of last year's massacre at a New Zealand mosque. One of the groups that's still quarantined is the Red Pill. It's full of misogynistic posts talking about ways to pressure women into sex or how women are genetically inferior to men. Many have asked, why not take it down entirely?
Our job at Reddit is to try to provide a kind of reflection of what's going on in the world, not to provide a squeaky clean, sanitized view of the world.
As long as social media sites profess to embrace free speech, there's probably no danger of that kind of unsavory content disappearing. I'm Jasmine Garst for Marketplace.
This final note on the way out today, because sometimes you just got to take a stand as a matter of principle. You know, no marketplace angle on this one, just honor at stake. Pete Rose, we learned today, has applied to the Commissioner of Major League Baseball for reinstatement. Rose was permanently banned in 1989 for betting on games, including games played by the Cincinnati Reds while he was managing that team. Rose says in a petition obtained by ESPN that his punishment doesn't match the league's punishment of the players who cheated during the Houston Astros sign-stealing World Series-winning 2017 season, which was none, no punishment. So herewith, a modest proposal. Do what you will with Pete Rose, but vacate that Astros title, maybe ban some of the players for life. All right, we got to go. Dow Industrial's up 483 today, 1.6%. NASDAQ up 0.44%. S&P 500 up 37 points. That's about 1.1% there. Our media production team includes Sarah Bruguer, Robin Edgar, Drew Jostad, Jeff Peters, Daniel Ramirez, Jay Siebold, Charlton Thorpe, and Ben Talladay. I'm Kai Rizdahl. We will see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APM.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.